Welcome to Beyond the Divide, where we cut through the noise to discover the truth that we're all just people and we're in this together. I want to shift gears just a little bit today and talk about another epidemic that is currently gripping the United States. And you might not think this is an epidemic, it's not been defined as one. But when we get into it, I think you'll see that this is a major problem. Rage is defined as violent, uncontrollable anger. The expanded definition states that rage is intense, uncontrolled anger that is an increased stage of hostile response to a perceived egregious injury or injustice. Now, this is just a perceived injustice or injury. Today, rage is boiling over in the headlines. It's on highways, it's in heated debates. From road rage incidents to mass shootings and political fury, anger seems to be everywhere. So I want to jump into the numbers because they're actually pretty staggering. And until I started doing some research for this podcast, I didn't realize just how large of a percentage this is affecting. A recent poll reveals that 84% of Americans believe that we are angrier as a nation than in previous generations. 42% admit they are personally feeling that anger. And it's not just a feeling, it's showing up in our daily lives. On the roads, 82% of drivers admit to engaging in road rage or aggressive driving at least once in the past year. And about half of us, at 49%, say that driving has become more dangerous since the pandemic, with road rage playing a big role. But it goes beyond the highways. We've got mass shootings that are often fueled by unchecked rage, 647 of them in 2022 alone. Among young people, nearly two-thirds of U.S. adolescents have experienced intense anger attacks involving threats, property damage, or violence toward others. Even the news cycle is a trigger. 29% of people report feeling angry often when checking headlines. Overall, 7 to 11% of the population deals with significant anger issues that disrupt their daily lives. Social media echoes this too. Recent posts on X highlight everything from manlet rage in fights to political fury over events like concerts gone wrong, painting a picture of society on an edge. It's clear that rage isn't just isolated incidents. It's woven into the fabric of American life. It's amplified by the stress that we feel, the division that we feel, and the constant connectivity to things like social media and the internet. So there are five phases of anger. And to truly understand the rage epidemic, we need to break it down. Anger isn't just a sudden explosion, it's a process. Psychologists have defined five stages. It's much like a cycle that can escalate or de-escalate if it's managed properly. So first you have the trigger phase. This is the spark. It's an event. It's a word, it's a situation that sets you off and it sets off an emotional response. It could be something small like a driver cutting you off, or something bigger like viewing a heated political debate. From the trigger phase, we have escalation. So here's where the anger starts to build. Your heart rate quickens, your thoughts race, and you start rationalizing your fury. Physical signs can come out in this stage, like clenched fists or raised voices, and they appear as adrenaline surges. Third, we have the crisis, and this is the peak point of the anger. This is kind of the point of no return. If you haven't gotten your anger in check by this point, then it's hard to do it once you reach the crisis phase. And this phase can manifest as yelling, physical aggression, or violence. And rational thinking starts to take a back seat when you hit the crisis phase. After the crisis, you have recovery. So the bulk of the anger starts to pass. You might start to feel regret or justification for your anger, but the intensity fades. And after that, most people go into what's called a post-crisis depression. So after the rage subsides, there's often a low kind of exhaustion. You have guilt, you have sadness. Some call it a depression phase where you reflect on what happened. And typically, it's here where you learn exactly why you reacted the way that you did, and you can potentially break the cycle for the next time that this happens. These stages that are drawn from models in anger management show that anger is predictable and manageable, and recognizing them early on can prevent escalation, especially in a society where triggers are everywhere. We always hear, oh, this is a trigger word. And that's a kind of a new thing. We didn't really use the phrase trigger word until about 2023. And then it seemed like everyone everywhere was triggered by everything. And there's warnings on posts, you know, this contains a trigger image or contains a trigger, you know, dialogue, things like that. But it didn't used to be that way. So this kind of came about rather quickly. Now we can connect this to our leadership, our elites. Strong words from people in positions of power don't just echo, they have real consequences. Inflammatory rhetoric can normalize anger and lower inhibitions and incite action. Studies show that hateful speech from leaders correlates with spikes in real-world violence, as it amplifies existing divisions and gives permission to act on rage. We have seen this time and time and time again, from the Black Lives Matter summer, up till now. Things have escalated almost beyond a point where we can control them. There was so much hate and rage and burning buildings, destroying government property, spray painting, you know, breaking windows. There were shootings, there were massive riots. And it seems like since that time, every time there is something that doesn't sit well, then our elites call for rioting in the streets. And it doesn't really matter which side you're on, because in some element, you're going to respond to that. Either you're going to be a rioter or you're going to be somebody out there trying to prevent damage. And this is okay for them. They don't care that the words that they're saying are having this kind of an effect. They want it to be that way. Some of them are calling for it to be this way. In the US, we have seen time and time again how political figures' violent language has increased over time, and it's contributing to a rise in politically motivated attacks. One analysis found at least 54 criminal cases where a prominent leader's name was invoked in connection with a violent act or threat. And this isn't abstract. It fuels the rage epidemic by modeling behavior that cascades through society. This week's shooting on an ICE facility in Texas is just the latest in a string of political violence that is propelled forward because our elites and our government officials are making them out to be an enemy. As President Trump recently stated, we must confront the fact that violence and murder are the tragic consequence of demonizing those with whom you disagree. You may not agree, but that doesn't give you the right to incite violence. In 1994, there was a country called Rwanda. And that year, they descended into one of the worst genocides of the 20th century. They claimed up to 800,000 lives in just 100 days. And that genocide was fueled from inflammatory rhetoric from leaders that were in power. Rwanda is a small East African country, and it's got three main ethnic groups. There's the Hutus, which make up about 85% of the population. The Tutsis make up 14%, and the Tiwas make up 1%. And these groups share the same language and culture, but colonial powers deepened divisions among them by favoring Tutsis in administration and education, which created resentment among the Hutus. And this country's kind of been passed around. First, Germany had it, then Belgium had it after World War I. And so, as they're kind of being thrown back and forth between different countries after wars, different things were, brought on because you had different leaders, you had different countries in power. And so they had kind of different ideas about how things should run. So it got a little bit confusing, and the three groups of the population really came to resent one another. So after they claimed their independence in 1962, a Hutu-led government kind of reversed this favoring of the Tutsis. They discriminated against them through quotas and periodic violence. In the 70s and the 80s, many of the Tutsis fled to neighboring countries like Uganda, forming the Rwandan Patriotic Front. This is the RPF. And it was a rebel group that kind of rose up to challenge the Hutu government. So by the early 90s, economic pressures, there was overpopulation, and there was a civil war that started when the RPF invaded from their hiding place in Uganda. So this all heightened tensions in Rwanda. And Hutu extremists began to spread propaganda through radio, television, that kind of thing. And they were dehumanizing the Tutsis, calling them cockroaches and snakes. And they were stoking fears among the people of a Tutsi domination over the people, which, when you're told time and time again that these people are bad and they're scary and they're murderers and they're thieves and they're going to come and they're going to attack your homes and your families, that gets pretty scary. So the Hutus, who are the main part of the population, they were very scared of the Tutsis. And the government was urging the Hutu people to exterminate the Tutsis. And it wasn't spontaneous. This was very orchestrated hate speech from people that were in positions of authority, and it was broadcast daily to whip up rage and fear. So even back then, we still had echo chambers, not anything like we do now with social media, but even radio and television was just constantly pounding this into the Hutu people. So on April 6th, 1994, there was a plane that was carrying the Rwandan president and the Burundian president, and it was shot down near Kigali, and they were both killed. And the perpetrators of the attack, it's still not totally known, but the Hutu extremists immediately blamed the RPF. So the Tutsis for the attack, and they used it to launch the genocide. Within hours of the plane crash, Hutu militias, soldiers, and civilians began systematic killings. Roadblocks were set up to check IDs and target the Tutsis and moderate Hutus who opposed the violence. The genocide officially began on April 7th and lasted until mid-July 1994. So they were raiding homes, they were pulling people over on the roads, and if you were found to be a Tutsi, you were immediately killed. Over 100 days, an estimated 800,000 to 1 million people were killed. And it was mostly Tutsis, but there was also some moderate Hutus and some Tiwas. This was approximately 70% of the Tutsi population. Killings were often carried out with machetes, clubs, and guns in homes, churches, schools, and stadiums where people sought refuge. Mass rapes and mutilations were widespread, with up to 500,000 women and girls being assaulted. And this was led by the Hutu power movement within the government, including figures, you know, very prominent figures. And ordinary citizens were being coerced and encouraged to participate through propaganda, peer pressure, and incentives like looting the victim's property. If you go into somebody's house that you know to be a Tutsi and you kill them all, then you can take whatever you want from their home. Lists of targets were prepared in advance. It was very highly organized. Ordinary people were inflamed by the words of their leaders, and they picked up machetes and they turned on their neighbors. The killings spread from Kigali to rural areas at a rate of about 8,000 deaths per day. That was faster than during the Holocaust. More lives were taken during the Holocaust, but at a slower rate. International reports later confirmed that this rhetoric directly incited the violence, turning a simmering ethnic tension into mass murder. And this is a stark reminder that when leaders use strong, divisive language, it doesn't just polarize, it leads to bloodshed. The world at large failed to intervene. The United Nations had a peacekeeping force in Rwanda, but it was underfunded and unmanned at the time. After 10 Belgian peacekeepers were killed early on, most of the troops were withdrawn, leaving just a skeleton force. And at the time, the U.S. was still reeling from Somalia and the conflicts there. And they did not want to call it genocide because they wanted to evade legal obligations under the Genocide Convention. So they were unwilling to recognize it as genocide. France, which had supported the regime, was accused of complicity. And only in June did France actually launch a limited humanitarian operation, but it was criticized for protecting some of the perpetrators. RPF advanced from the north and eventually stopped the genocide by capturing Kigali on July 4th, 1994, and then the rest of the country soon after. In America today, echoes of this dynamic appear in polarized discourse where words from the top can spark unrest. History demands and warns us to hold those in power accountable. In today's pop culture scene, there are countless ways which we and our children are exposed to rage. From music to video games to movies to reels on social media, we're confronted with the rage of others on a daily basis, multiple times a day. I can't help but think of so many of the reels I've seen, and one in particular that really stands out in my mind was shortly after it was announced that Ruth Bader Ginsburg had passed away. There were quite a few people that were really upset. And she had died just a couple of months before the administration would have changed. And so there would have been a Democratic president who was able to elect or nominate a justice to replace her. But she died at the time that we still had a Republican president. And so he was able to replace her. And this angered a lot of people. And there's this reel that is so clear in my mind of this woman, and she's in a car and she is like beating the crap out of her steering wheel. And she's just like pulling on it and she's just, slamming her head against the back of her seat. And she is like yelling about this poor woman. And she's like demanding answers as to why she died when she did, rather than waiting a few more months when the administration would have changed. Like, as if Ruth could have controlled the time of her death. Like, crazy, complete craziness. And there are some others that come to mind when I hear about someone raging after being upset over their video games. And these games are so violent. Guys, you need to understand, today's video games are not like Mario Brothers and the games that we played as kids. They are so violent. They're bloody, they're gory, and they are rewiring our children's brains and our brains, if you're someone who plays these. There are MRI studies that show an increase in the workings of the anterior cortex, which is the area of the brain that's designed to control emotion while these types of games are being played. And aggression is the primary emotion that's coming out of the anterior cortex. Such games are priming aggressive thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. They desensitize us to violence and they tweak brain circuits to have more aggressive thoughts over time. There are so many viral reels today that show young men getting so angry over losing during one of these games that they literally break their controllers into pieces, which is not easy to do. Now, remember that negativity gets clicks. Clicks make money. The echo chambers of social media then reflect back at you what you most commonly click on. So even if you start off, and you click on one of these reels and you're just laughing about it, eventually the echo chamber starts to just throw this kind of stuff at you all day long, every day, and then that's all that you see. And it starts to fundamentally rewire your brain for aggression. And there's a very famous story from the Bible that deals with rage. I know you all know it, so I'm just going to briefly summarize the story of Cain and Abel. Adam and Eve were the first humans. They had two sons. Cain, the elder, was a farmer, and Abel, the younger, was a shepherd. And they were taught in the ways of God. They were taught to have faith, and they were taught to make sacrifice in appreciation for what God had given them. So Abel, being a shepherd, brought forth the firstborn of his flock and offered it as a sacrifice to God. Cain, being a farmer, offered crops from his fields. And the Bible doesn't really tell us why, but God accepted Abel's offering but rejected Cain's. And it's possible it's because Abel gave the best, firstborn of his flock, and he gave it with a pure heart. And Cain's offering possibly lacked the same sincerity. Well, we don't really know. It doesn't tell us. So God rejects Cain's offering, and Cain becomes furious, and he feels rejected by God. And God comes to him and he says, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, you will be accepted. But if you don't do what is right, Then sin is crouching at your door, and it desires to have you, but you have to figure out how to rule over it. As we all must. But Cain did not heed God's advice. He let the rage fester inside him, and he lured Abel into a field, and he killed him in a fit of jealousy and anger. And then he hid him. And when God came to Cain again and asked, "Where is your brother Abel?" Cain callously replied, "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And God, of course, knowing all things, he already knew what had happened. And he confronted Cain again, and he told him that Abel's blood cries out from the ground. So at this point, Cain knows he's busted. And God curses Cain for his actions. And he declares that the ground would no longer yield crops for him, and that he would be a restless wanderer. So he could no longer be a farmer because the ground was not going to produce for him, and he would spend his days wandering the earth. And Cain was fearful for his life because he was like, when future posterities find out that I killed my brother, they're just going to come after me and they're going to kill me. And he was afraid. And so God put a curse or placed a mark on Cain to protect him from being killed by others. And we don't know exactly what that was, but, you know, God in his infinite mercy still protected him. But Cain's punishment was very severe. He was exiled, he was separated from his family and from God's presence, and now he has to live with the guilt of his brother's death. That's a heavy weight, I imagine, and he has walked the earth ever since dealing with that guilt. One of my favorite songs is by Thomas Rhett. It's titled Be a Light. And some of the lyrics say, "In a time full of war, be peace. In a time full of doubt, just believe. There ain't that much difference between you and me. In a time full of war, be peace. In a place that needs change, make a difference. In a time full of noise, just listen. Life is but a breeze, live it. In a place that needs change, make a difference. In a world full of hate, be a light. When you do somebody wrong, make it right. Don't hide in the dark, you were born to shine. In a world full of hate, be a light." I want you guys to have faith in your ability to bring positive change to this world. You were saved for a time such as this. God will help you know what to say and what to do. You can be a light, you can make a difference, and you were born to shine. Remember that a candle placed on a bushel cannot shine brightly for others. Do not hide your light. Trust in God, trust in your faith. Be the change that we need to see in the world. Enjoy your weekend, guys. Connect with someone. Find that common thread. Make a difference in the world. Have a great one. Thanks so much for joining me.